There is a difference in all of that too, in people having passion, and people being able to debate robustly. Of course, they must be able to do that, but there are lines that cannot and must not be crossed. And I think everyone has to be able to police their own behaviour as far as that's concerned.
That was SNP Westminster Group Leader Ian Blackford, and we'll hear more from them later in the show. Hello and welcome to The Stooshie, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson Media that helps you be better briefed. I'm Paul Malik, and on this episode I'll be joined by Adele Merson and Andy Phillips to examine and explain the last week in Scottish politics. But first, a summary of the week's biggest national and international politics stories, compiled and read by Morag Lindsay.
Vulnerable people could face intangible pressure to end their lives if the law on assisted dying is relaxed, the Archbishop of Canterbury has warned. The House of Lords is debating a new bill to enable terminally ill adults to legally seek assistance to end their lives. Similar proposals are also being brought back separately at the Scottish Parliament. Foreign Secretary Liz Truss will use a two-day visit to India to announce a series of technology and infrastructure deals aimed at boosting trade links and combating climate change. The UK government has also been on a trade mission to India to discuss opportunities for increased Scotch whisky exports from Scotland. Glasgow City Council's leader, Susan Aitken, claims she is dealing with fly-tipping before the COP26 summit on climate change, but she admitted there are still some major hotspots to clean up. Ms Aitken said the pandemic has had a significant impact on the city's cleansing services, but she insisted the litter situation is improving.
Thank you, Morag. Now, as we start the show, I think it's appropriate to address a piece of news that would have appeared missing on last week's episode. We recorded early on Friday morning, which meant that we were unable to cover the horrific murder of Southend West MP Sir David Amess. Now, Andy and I have spent the week in London on a prearranged trip to Westminster, where we were able to experience the sombre mood and heightened tensions that have once again gripped the nation's capital. Andy, it's fair to say that there was quite a reflective period ongoing while we were down in Westminster, compiled with sort of extra security checks and a somber tone across everything and everyone we met, wasn't there?
Yeah, you could sense it straight away. Not least just the very visible changes. I mean, just getting into any sort of official building, whether it's Parliament, government, departments, or anything like that. I mean, it's passports out and long queues and, you know, searches. And though you could tell from the security staff as well that there was a sense of nervousness, not just. I mean, it's happened so many times now, whether it's police officers, security at the door, politicians. It's happening with such alarming frequency that it's absolutely no surprise that it appeared like such a blow across all levels. Clearly, we were meeting people who were trying to be professional and they have a job to do every day, but. You know, everybody that we spoke to, whether they were officials, MPs, secretaries of state, they were. It was clearly had been like a blow to everyone, whether they were in the party, whether they even knew the man very well. It was a real sense of collective shock that you could feel everywhere for days.
I would agree with that. Sir David certainly did seem someone, even if he was predominantly a backbench MP for most of his career, he was someone that touched and was close to everyone from every party. We spoke with Ian Blackford, the group leader at Westminster, on the tone of debate and the importance of making sure that politics remains something that we can be lively about. But recently we seem to have collectively as a country maybe stepped over the line too much. You know, this is the second MP that's been murdered since 2016 and the third MP to be attacked. And we obviously had the horrific murder of Joe Cox several days before the Brexit referendum vote, in which time it sort of became clear that everyone wanted to change the style and the tone of debate. And unfortunately, I don't think that has happened. We obviously like a stern debate and a frank exchange of views is good for politics, and it's good for the health of debate in this country. But it does seem sometimes that things can go too far. Adele, you've spoken and written at great length about the abuse that female MPs and MSPs and councillors and even just women involved in politics go through. It's something that has been rumbling for too long now, isn't it? And it's something that we really have to stop with just words saying enough is enough, let's change, and actually make the correct actions, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, I think it's just a crazy place to be when it seems almost every MP or every second MP can give you examples of threats and abuse that they receive on a daily basis. And as you say, politics has always been spirited. It's been people with very strong opinions debating each other. But it does feel like, I don't know when you would say it began, but certainly for the last few years, that things have, the kind of political discussion that's happening, it's no longer a spirited debate. It crosses into these kind of everyone's in a camp and there can be no nuance, and everyone's got to take like a hard stance on everything. And then it goes beyond the policy and it becomes deeply personal, which, yeah, in the current climate with everything that's happening, you know, every single week there's just depressing storylines about women, whether it's these recent reports about getting spiked by injection, or whether it's the abuse that female politicians face, or whether it's the murder of women that are just walking home. It just adds to this feeling of, if you're getting abuse via the internet, you know, toxic kind of political abuse, you no longer maybe you can just brush it off in the same way that maybe you've had to before. You now see these real life examples right before you, where you think every single threat you get has to be taken incredibly seriously. And I can't imagine what people feel like in that situation. They must just, you know, surgeries is something that every single politician does, and they will have heard this news, and some of them will have had a surgery to go to that day, I imagine, or the following day. And it's just, I can't tell you what the answer is, but there needs to be concrete action of some kind, because as you can see, it's just completely stepped over the line recently on many fronts.
As mentioned earlier, we spoke with SNP Westminster Group Leader Ian Blackford, where we asked him about the importance of the tone of debate and what could maybe be done to stop anonymous online attacks.
So, two bits to that, and I do think that every member of parliament is a leader and has a responsibility to lead by example. And I think there is a difference in all of that too, in people having passion, and people being able to debate robustly. Of course, they must be able to do that, but there are lines that cannot and must not be crossed. And I think everyone has to be able to police their own behaviour as far as that's concerned. I've listened to other people on this issue of anonymity on social media, and I do think it's a problem, and I think the problem has got worse. But I'm also aware of protection for whistleblowers and things like that. If we can get to a situation where, in my opinion, that there are adequate protections for the likes of whistleblowers, but we can deal with the position of anonymity, and of course the responsibility that social media companies have as well. And I thought actually, Marc Francois spoke quite eloquently on that issue yesterday in terms of the harms bill as well. So we have to take this seriously. We can't just pay lip service to it, and we can't have this situation. And I have to say that, I mean, if I just look at what happened post-Friday and the stuff on Twitter and Facebook, we are still seeing behaviour which, quite frankly, is unacceptable. And it has to be called out.
So we heard from Ian Blackford there. Adele. So Ian Blackford is suggesting that we could make some anonymous Twitter accounts who seem to dole out quite a lot of the worst abuse on social media, a thing of the past, but then has concerns about whistleblowers or people using the internet to stay anonymous, which when it came about that was one of the beauties of the internet, was that you could be anonymous, and it seems to have been hijacked by trolls. We know that there are politicians who've been running some of these troll accounts as well. We have our own examples of Lady Whistledown in Angus with the Conservative councillors. Do we think that this is the way that in the wake of Sir David's murder and then really still in the aftermath of Joe Cox's death that this is the right thing that we should be talking about, or is there a lot more structurally when it comes to abuse that we should be tackling?
I think social media companies certainly have a lot to answer for. I think certainly I'm not saying abuse didn't happen, but abuse has always been there, but social media is giving much more of a platform for politicians to, you know, there's good and bad with that though, but it's not me calling for. Social media also helps democracy in lots of ways and helps politicians reach lots of their voters and the electorate. But the flip side of that is they hear, you know, it's not really normal to go on the internet and to just read screeds and screeds and screeds of abuse that's directed at you. That's probably not what they would have experienced in a pre-social media era. So certainly the social media companies have a lot to answer for. I don't know whether the anonymous aspect is probably, like, whether getting rid of anonymous accounts will really necessarily help. I think abuse will still happen. Abuse comes from people that are identified on social media as well. You could say that a lot of these anonymous accounts have next to no followers. Like you'll see them yourselves when you're on the internet and you get this kind of, you get someone message you whatever and you see they've got 10 followers or something. I don't necessarily think it's just these anonymous accounts that are the problem. You're getting people abusing each other that have thousands and thousands of followers. So I guess the criticism that's been leveled at certainly websites like Twitter is they just don't, when the complaints are made, when people are reported, it's not necessarily always taken that, or the perception is that it's not always taken, action isn't taken that fast or that seriously. So certainly social media companies have really big questions to answer around that.
And Andy, one of the things that Ian Blackford touched upon when we were talking to him last week was that he doesn't think he would recommend to any young people to get involved in frontline politics. It's a bit of a sorry state of affairs if the leader of the party in Westminster is saying that he couldn't encourage anyone because of the amount of abuse that they would face.
Yeah, I think that actually stood out among much of the words that we heard that we probably expected about the sorrow and the grief and the anger and then the concern and the fears. But to distill that into a sort of a quick moment of soul searching where he basically thought, how could I tell someone in, you know, this is the job for you. You should come and pursue a career in politics. I thought that was an absolutely terrible verdict to have to admit to. And it's basically says everything you need to know about what kind of position we've got to. I think slightly connected to that, I look back at the former Scottish Labour leader, Kezia Dugdale. I mean, she left and there was an angry vibe around politics anyway at that point. And she left and went off to join a centre at a university connected sort of department where she wants to try and show politics as a place where you can be a force for good and it's all positive, and she wanted to try and improve the image and encourage more young people into politics, and I sort of try and weigh up those two things and you have to ask whether or not it's possible to do that. I mean, I'm sure that if this is addressed again now, then that could be changed, but it does illustrate that without a significant degree of change, it's not the kind of place where you could imagine it being particularly that much fun, as a career, as a, if you're motivated by trying to improve the country around you and you get into it and all you're going to get is abuse or worse, then it's quite dispiriting really.
And it does seem to be exacerbated by big events. Just to touch upon when we were leaving Westminster, physically walking down into the tube station to go home on Friday, I saw someone being arrested. And it turns out they were being arrested because they'd erected a gallows on Parliament Square facing Westminster. Now, this was less than a week after an MP has been murdered. And someone thinks it's a sensible idea to put a gallows with a noose on Parliament Square, so the MPs and their staff and journalists and members of the public and tourists see this What sort of reflection is that of us as a UK society, or as a European nation, or as a country as a whole, that someone would think that because of a disagreement that they have with politics as a whole, or that they disagree with something said, that is acceptable. I remember it's felt like that for some time as well. I mean, if you remember the 2019 election, which felt horrible to report on, and if you remember the atmosphere around Westminster then, when you had people on the Remain side and the Leave side screaming at you as you walked past, you know, we all laughed about the man who was on the BBC that would shout "Stop Brexit," but it was intimidating. It you couldn't do your work, and it meant that MPs were having to remove their lanyards and have to sort of skulk around in the dark, which the last thing you want MPs to do is to be forced to work sort of beneath the transparency. I struggle sometimes to think how this improves, and I can understand why Ian Blackford would tell a young person not to get involved. It's one that unfortunately I think we'll talk about at great length for some time to come. To move on, we had the news earlier this week, which led to a lot of dejected voices and faces amongst Scotland's Conservative MPs after the Peterhead Carbon Capture, or the ACORN project, or as I'm about to get a screwed up and angry face from Andy Phillip, the so-called Scottish Cluster, which would have seen millions, if not billions of pounds of investment into green energy capture off the coast of Peterhead on a new project, was unceremoniously dumped and given to a company in Humberside. This was after Douglas Ross and his fellow party members said, keep an eye out for the energy announcement later this week. I think it might be good news for the North East. Adele, you were covering this story for us this week. Talk us through just what happened and just what implications this will have for the so-called just transition, or net zero transition, or whatever they're calling it this week, and for the people in the North East.
Yes, it's safe to say people are raging, for want of a better word, about this decision. I think, as you say, there was sort of, nobody said for sure, but there were hints. Greg Hands visited the North East just at the week before, days before the decision. And then you had Boris Johnson sort of hinting at the project having a good chance, I think, in the weeks before. And certainly the group of the Scottish Clusters, as they're called, they felt that the North East was absolutely primed for this development. We have the expertise up here. You've got skilled engineers. You've got people that are looking to, or are losing their jobs and looking to go into cleaner forms of energy. And we have the pipelines set up, some redundant pipelines, that were once used to sort of extract gas from oil fields. So they feel they had the skills, the expertise, the infrastructure, and they've just snubbed the region, basically. And I think what's key here as well is that this isn't the first time that this has happened. I think we had back in 2007, there was a BP project at Peterhead that was abandoned. And then in 2015, there was another Peterhead, but it was, I think, a Shell-led project that was going to be going ahead. And then the funding was pulled kind of at the last minute. So I guess people feel just let down yet again. And this is all in the climate of, we're days away from, sorry, what was it now, over a week away from COP26. Scotland's ministers have said that this plan will really hamper the progress towards becoming net zero if we don't have that carbon capture technology projects up in Scotland. And it's not a good look. And it's not a good look in the climate of people are losing their jobs up here, and there's a lot of warm words about this just transition and new jobs, but then you see projects like this just then fall apart, and it just does not leave a good kind of taste in the mouth at all for a lot of people up here.
Here's what Ian Blackford had to say about the rug pull, if you will, for want of a better phrase.
It's not great, and I have to say we're pretty devastated about this, about what it means for us. So let's concentrate on Scotland PLC, if I can put it that way, because we need to deliver on our climate change targets. We need to get to net zero. I would argue that we need to quicken the pace on this. And just the imagery of this announcement today, a couple of weeks ahead of COP26, it's not great. And of course there are competing bids that have to be looked at, but we know that the ACORN project met the criteria. The northeast of Scotland is home of the oil and gas industry. To a large extent, the infrastructure already exists. The pipelines are there. And it's not just about the northeast, of course. It's also about Grangemouth as well and the journey that INEOS are on. I mean, it's so important to our green industrial future. So I know you've sort of said that it's not happening for now, but I mean, how many times? Because let's remember that this was promised way back in 2014 when Ed Davey was the energy minister in the UK government, cancelled in 2015. So this really is, to say it's regrettable, I'm trying to use my language carefully in the spirit of where we are this week, but this is not great. And when you consider that the Scottish government has announced a £500 million investment in just transition, we really need the UK government to step up to the plate as well. And they have failed to do that. And let's be honest, there's a challenge for all of us in that transition to that green economy. And this is such an integral part of that transition. And if we take the figures from the ACORN project, and I would have to say, I would highlight how they have conducted themselves over the course of the last few months. And I think everything that they have said has been battened down properly. And the analysis that they had done, that if they had been greenlit for this, then we'd be talking about 15,000 jobs. And it's not just the fact you're talking about 15,000 jobs, you're talking about 15,000 well-paid jobs in the green economy for Scotland. So this is not great. And I mean, I can say to you that we have tried to work on a cross-party basis. We have tried to get a meeting with Kwasi Kwarteng over the course of the last few weeks, and I was doing that jointly with Ian Murray and Andrew Bowie, and the invitation was there for the Conservatives to join us. And the minister has led us a merry dance because we still haven't had that meeting. We have a meeting next week after the decision and after the announcement. So this is not good enough. And if we are serious about everything that we see from the climate crisis, because that's what it is, then we need these things to happen. And being told that the Scottish project is in reserve is simply not good enough. And it does demonstrate for us that we really need to have these powers in Scotland, because the only thing you can say which addresses your question is that the Scottish Conservatives are not important enough to the Prime Minister.
Now, Andy, Ian, Mr. Blackford touched upon something there. Douglas Ross has, since the decision been made, come out and said that the decision to send it to the cluster or the project in Humberside was because that they obviously had a better application. And then he was drawn a blank when he asked what made it better than the one that the ACORN project had sent on. It does seem that the Scottish Conservatives, for all of the talk that they gave this project and all of the supposed support that they projected that the UK government had for the Northeast, didn't really were as much out of the loop as any of the rest of us as to why ACORN is not getting this work that on paper really should just be delivered.
Yeah, it's been interesting for the Conservatives in the Northeast for a while on a number of things like this, where they were successful to a sort of degree, you know, in recent times of portraying themselves as quite a distinct group. They're not, you know, they're not Boris Johnson. They're a bit different, and you can back them to, you know, to stand up for interests in the Northeast. But it keeps happening. Like, look at the response to, let's say, an energy crisis and fuel, where you think, well, you look at the north of Scotland in particular, and you think about the household bills, cost of heating, things like this. And then you think, okay, then what about farming and agriculture? And you look at how, you know, we've come to this incredible position where we're thinking of slaughtering animals just to unblock the pipeline rather than because they're being, you know, raised for food. And then the, you know, the business community are told, we've got your back. And then, you know, again, Boris Johnson's end of the bargain sends it somewhere else. And then, of course, that led to the discussion about the Conservatives' opponents anyway, saying, well, perhaps Boris Johnson's more interested in the so-called red wall, the gains that they made from Labour in England, and that's what they're trying to sort of cement more at the expense of focusing on somewhere like Aberdeen, Aberdeenshire, Moray, these places. So if these things are allowed to build up, then that's where it becomes a bit of a problem. On their own, is it that long-term damage? Maybe not. I mean, there's no election on the horizon. There's no immediate ramifications. And the, you know, the Conservatives' opponents still have their own problems. I mean, the SNP they've already got to a position where they were clipped back a bit by the electorate for entirely separate reasons, which these decisions don't actually address. I mean, we've had Brexit, we've talked about fishing, we talked about all those things. Where does the momentum go? I think we're in a bit of a kind of a little holding pattern at the moment where we can just wait and see which way it goes.
And Ian Blackford touched upon the idea of Scotland having the powers to make these decisions for themselves. Probably about as clear as he possibly could have been in any discussion with us this week on plans for another referendum, as in, doesn't sound like he has a great deal of them. Andy, first of all, what was Mr. Blackford saying or not saying about a push for another referendum before the end of the parliamentary term while we were down in London?
Well, that sort of segues neatly in from what I was just saying, because the SNP have had their problems, and most of them are about filling in the gaps for the electorate and for business and for people who want to know, well, what's the plan? Whether you agree with, say, the push for a second referendum or not, either side is looking for an answer. Well, what does it mean? How would it look? What's the legal route? And that, then before you get back into the age-old questions about practicalities such as mortgages, pensions, currency, things like that. So he was given multiple opportunities to sort of address the points being raised by people on his own side as much as pro-union figures. Can you explain what the legal route is for a referendum? Much in the way that we constantly ask the Conservative government, you know, why, you know, how can Scotland ever have a legal route if you always just say no, regardless of who gets returned to Parliament or what the polls sit at or anything like that? But Ian Blafford didn't. He just said we'll have a plan, we'll have a referendum. It'll be towards the end of, you know, X year, and but then you ask for details and we don't know. And then we think, well, there was a Supreme Court judgment the other day with ramifications about the legalities of the Scottish Parliament doing one thing where they might not have competence. Again, a bit vague on how that might be interpreted if the Scottish Parliament were to push forward their own referendum. The problem is that they're now in a place where people on the same side aren't very happy, as well as people on the opposite side. And that creates a new dynamic that the SNP hasn't really had to deal with in the past.
So this is that split with the ALBA party?
That would be the most obvious example of it. I mean, the reason, they don't think that there's a proper plan. They don't think Nicola Sturgeon's going fast enough, which is, it's quite funny to see sometimes where you know, the SNP say something and immediately people on both sides say, that's too fast and that's too slow. So
a conundrum. Adele, Mr. Blackford said that the most important thing for him would be to win the hearts and minds during the referendum, and that things like currency were solved. I must have missed it. Andy, do you feel that you missed the currency debacle being solved? How much, Adele, do you think the party pushing for independence, telling us that probably the largest sticking issue, which held the debate for so long in 2014, has just been magically solved? We'll go down with voters in the event of another referendum.
No, I mean, the argument for heart and minds is important, but effectively the people that support independence at the moment already have been probably won over on the kind of hearts and minds argument. And the people that you're now trying to get to push you over to get that kind of majority vote in support of independence are probably the people that perhaps over the last couple of years have been won over in a hearts and minds sense in seeing some of the differences between the two governments and how they've dealt with coronavirus, perhaps. But I'd argue that what they're still waiting on is the kind of financial aspects, economic aspects, the more technical parts. And for some people, that will be the kind of key to them potentially changing their mind from no to yes. And so I think those things are going to prove really important for those people that still sit on the fence, is it's those people that are still on the fence that need to be brought over to yes. So no, I mean, I don't think those questions have been explained or settled yet.
Well, I'm sure, as with all things Scottish politics, we will be discussing this plenty more in future. But that's all we have time for this week. Thank you to Adele and Andy, producer Morven, and of course to you for listening. We'll be back next week with more. But until then, pick up or log on to The Courier, The Press and Journal, and all of our news brands so that you can be better briefed. Cheerio!
The Stooshie is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you can be better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, Evening Express and The Sunday Post work hard day and night, online, in print and beyond, to bring you careful reporting and analysis designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, in Westminster and in our communities. So you don't miss an episode, follow The Stooshie today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know folk like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune into The Stooshie or follow Stooshie Scott on Twitter and Facebook. You can get a free month of unlimited access to The Courier or The Press and Journal too. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed. Check the episode notes for details and terms.